Today is Monday, the 19th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Afghanistan tells its diplomats to leave Pakistan.
It is very crucial at this stage that Pakistan and Afghanistan closely cooperate.
Plus, as floodwaters in Germany recede, what challenges face residents looking to rebuild?
They're really fighting also with a lack of electricity, gas, and running water.
And we start the week by taking a look at some emerging musical hitmakers on the African continent. We'll have these stories and more next. On Sunday, Afghanistan said that it had asked all of its diplomats in Pakistan to return to Kabul. This as Islamabad addresses all of what it is calling security risks and brings to justice those behind last week's brief abduction of the Afghan ambassador's daughter. VOA's Ayaz Gul is in Islamabad and shares the latest.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan is already fragile and, you know, marred by suspicions and mistrust. And now we see this incident that has taken place. Although it is still under investigation, and it happened on Friday afternoon, but for the first time, the Afghan embassy informed the Pakistani foreign ministry on Saturday, and then the investigation began, and Pakistan promised that they will quickly, unearth whoever was behind it. So while we were waiting for an outcome of the investigation, because most of the links they have been able to connect, dots they have been able to connect, like where she was, Afghan ambassador's daughter, you know, where she was traveling and how she got kidnapped. But then suddenly this Afghan foreign ministry issued a statement a couple of hours ago that Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has ordered all the diplomats, including the ambassador in Islamabad, to return to Kabul until this incident is properly investigated and those behind it are brought to justice.
What do we know more about the actual kidnapping incident itself? Because, you know, the information that's coming out from Afghanistan was that the ambassador's daughter was severely tortured. What have the authorities said about what happened?
This has been confirmed by the medical report that we have seen after her examination was conducted in a hospital in Islamabad that she was tortured, physically attacked. The statement that the lady has given to the police in Islamabad was that she was out for some kind of shopping for her brother, buying some gift. The interesting aspect of the whole event that she has described in her statement is that she was traveling in a rented car. Like, she wasn't traveling to this commercial area in Islamabad in the diplomatic vehicle, which, you know, the families and all diplomats are bound to use the diplomatic vehicles, which are properly secured. Instead, she was traveling in a cab. And that's when she said that while she was on her way home, this cab driver stopped the car. Some person, unknown individual, entered the car. And that's when he took her hostage for several hours. And then later she was found somewhere in a residential sector in Islamabad. So again, whatever we know so far about this whole incident is from what this victim has described to police. But today, the Pakistani Interior Minister, Sheikh Rashid, told a news conference that they have been able to collect all the footages of the CCTV cameras around Islamabad, and they have connected almost all the dots. Like, they can see the lady driving from one point to another point and to a third point. So they are hopeful, and they have already identified several cab drivers. You know, whether it was a criminal act or whether there were other motives, we still don't know, but it has really dealt a serious blow to an already troubled relationship between the two countries, because it is very crucial at this stage that Pakistan and Afghanistan closely cooperate, because both the countries share a very long border, and Pakistan has been credited with facilitating peace talks between the Afghan government representatives and the Taliban insurgents, which are going on in Qatar.
Ayaz Ghul spoke to me from Islamabad. Volunteers in the U.S. Pacific Northwest state of Oregon were working hard over the weekend to help some of the roughly 2,000 residents displaced from their homes as a sprawling wildfire rages mostly unchecked. Reuters reporter Chris Dignam is up next.
The massive bootleg fire continued to rage in southern Oregon on Sunday, scorching nearly 300,000 acres, destroying dozens of homes, and leaving roughly 2,000 residents displaced in Klamath County. On Friday, the Oregon Department of Forestry listed more than 5,000 homes as threatened, about 3,000 more than a day earlier. Valerie O'Dye, who helps head the charity Relief Angels, was in the small, tight-knit community of Bly to unload supplies, including food and bottled water, to the evacuees.
I was up on the mountain yesterday, and I was able to see some of the devastation and the heartache of people coming back to their homes where they've lived their whole lives. People that have built it literally with their own hands, and it's gone.
Lita Hunter, who heads the Bly Community Action Team, said she expects to see more requests for supplies as the wildfire continues to grow.
A lot of devastation going on in our area. So many people have come in to get supplies here that have completely lost everything. We had a load this morning, came from Silverton, Oregon, and we have a load in the morning coming from Portland. I am in awe of the donations we've received.
The bootleg fire, which erupted on July 6th, is the biggest among dozens of wildfires tearing across the tinder-dry landscape of the western United States, and forestry officials said it was Oregon's fifth largest blaze in more than a century. The cause is still under investigation.
Chris Dignam reports for Reuters News. As floodwaters recede in Germany, the death toll climbed to nearly 160 on Sunday, while officials begin the process of rebuilding affected areas. Reporter Sabina Devins spoke to me from Berlin.
So the latest numbers coming out of Germany right now is 157 have been confirmed dead in Germany. We have 30 more deaths already being calculated in Belgium and hundreds of injured. And with the missing numbers, we're seeing reports from anywhere from dozens from local communities to some national reporting, calculating as much as 1,300 people missing. That being said, officials are saying to take that number with a grain of salt because some people are just merely being reported missing because also communication lines are being down. So cell phone towers have also been wiped out. Some regions only have 20 to 30% of cell phone accessibility. The cell phone providers are in the cities right now setting up mobile spots. So we're hoping to get a more accurate idea of what the missing numbers are at the terms right now. So today we had further flooding in sort of eastern central regions of Germany, not quite at the same levels of what we had on Wednesday to Thursday night in North Rhine-Westphalia and as well as Rhineland-Palatinate. But we've already had one reported death coming out of the regions of northern Bavaria and I believe Saxony that's also suffering under heavy rain conditions today.
Now, you know, there's some reporting that floodwaters were starting to recede and that was going to be the impetus really for authorities and other people to go in to start the rebuilding efforts. And I was wondering what you could share with our listeners about what is being discussed to really help these communities who've been ravaged by the floodwaters to rebuild and what kind of challenges they face. You mentioned the communication issues, but what else are they facing?
So immediately right now for residents, they're really fighting also with a lack of electricity, gas, and running water. So a lot of residents are being told not to drink the tap water. Filtration plants in the regions were also compromised by the flooding. And we were also sort of seeing they're being told only to use water as much as necessary. So even not running washing machines, being careful about when to flush the toilet and all this. And this is for people who are still able to stay in their home. We're also sort of seeing infrastructure-wise, roadways have been wiped out. So even getting to the areas can be challenging. The federal army has put out 850 soldiers into the region to join volunteers that are cleaning up the area. But at the same time, the volunteer response has just been enormous. And of course, on the federal government side, The state of Rhineland-Palatinate, where about 110 people have died, that is really also the area of the Ahrweiler Valley that is the most heavily hit from this. They've already put out a 50 million euro emergency fund. And today, Finance Minister Olaf Scholz told a newspaper that he will be introducing a 300 million euro relief package to the Bundestag on Wednesday. So financial relief is on the way as well.
Now, Sabina, before I let you go, I understand that German Chancellor Angela Merkel was also on site today. What can you tell us about her visit?
So Angela Merkel visited the area today, touring areas in Rhineland-Palatinate with the state minister as well. She had also promised swift and rapid relief for the areas and also described the scene as eerie and ghostly. She even said the German language does not have words for this. More ambitiously, she also said that German politicians need to take a good hard look at their climate policies and say that serious actions need to be taken in the coming years. So we'll be watching for that in the upcoming election politics in the next couple months.
That was reporter Sabina Devins in Berlin. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is about to lift the entirety of England's COVID-19 restrictions on Monday. It's the only country in the United Kingdom where he has the power to do so. Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland all set their own policies. To see how people are reacting to the change as the Delta variant continues to spread, I spoke with reporter Victoria Smith in London.
Yeah, well, we're calling it Freedom Day here, Steve. And I'll tell you what's changing. No limits on how many people can get together. No social distancing anymore. And no masks, although the government says they still expect us to exercise some caution. Now, I can tell you, I've just come home from the centre of London on public transport. The masks are off. And it's a nation divided because there are those who feel they've had enough. If not now, when? They want things to go back to how they were before this little thing called COVID came along. And the other half of the nation is, frankly, pretty terrified because, as you know, we are riding the crest of a third wave here with case numbers going up exponentially, and we're still only 66% double vaccinated. Some people are saying, why not wait a bit longer? Scientists are saying, we're almost there with the vaccination program. Why not wait till more of us are vaccinated, including the under 18s, and then maybe ease some restrictions? But no, this government is going ahead on Monday with an easing of social restrictions, despite, of course, what's happened in the top tier of government today.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because the news has come out that Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the finance minister were in close contact with someone who had COVID-19. And of course, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson was hospitalized last year after contracting it.
Absolutely was. And yes, for all we know, he may have it again, although let's hope not, because it nearly took him last time. We understand it was 50-50 there. The someone, of course, that they were in contact with was none other than the Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, who announced he had tested positive. And of course, he'd been in the room with many senior members of government and many other people. Now, the real controversy with that is that we have this thing called the National Health Service app, which tells us if we've been in contact or near to somebody who's tested positive. And if that's the case, the rule is you self-isolate for 10 days. Unfortunately, Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, decided the rule didn't apply to them. They were not going to self-isolate like the rest of us are told to do. Instead, they were going to have daily tests. Now, this didn't look great when we're just about to have all these restrictions easing, and within 2.5 hours, the Prime Minister and his Chancellor had decided they would follow the rules laid down for the rest of us and indeed would self-isolate. So that's three of our top leading government ministers now having to self-isolate just before so-called Freedom Day, which doesn't look great. And it doesn't look great that they decided that really there was one rule for them and one rule for the rest of us. And that rule means that many of us, perhaps millions, will have to self-isolate over the coming months, with COVID cases predicted to rise, predicted to peak in August and September.
Victoria Smith in London. Tokyo Olympic organizers on Sunday reported the first COVID-19 cases among competitors residing in the athletes' village as its population swells ahead of the start of the pandemic-hit games next week. Reuters' Edward Baran has those details.
Two athletes from the same country and competing in the same sport staying in the village in the Harumi waterfront district tested positive for the virus, organisers said. Organisers on Sunday reported 10 new cases connected to the Olympics, down from 15 new cases a day earlier. South Africa reported 3 positive cases in its soccer squad. This is the response from the IOC's Olympic Games Executive Director, Christoph Duby.
There is no such thing as zero risk, and that we all agree. At the same time, the mingling and crossing of population is incredibly limited.
The new infections are testing the layered testing regime designed to ensure COVID cases are quickly caught and isolated. Proponents argue that the growing number of cases underscores the strength of the testing system. Infection rates are climbing among Tokyo's general population, topping 1,000 new cases for 5 consecutive days. Polls show many Japanese oppose holding the Games with the influx of overseas visitors it entails.
Reuters reporter Edward Baran. Coco Gauff announced on Sunday that she will not be competing in the Tokyo Olympics after she tested positive for COVID-19. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says government artillery fire has killed 7 civilians. The deaths, which included 3 children, occurred in the country's last major rebel city of Idlib. The French press agency reports the shelling took place hours after President Bashar al-Assad took the oath of office for a 4th term, pledging to liberate areas still beyond government control. Around 500,000 people have been killed during Syria's decade-long war. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa visited Johannesburg's Soweto Township Sunday to view badly damaged shopping centers. It's the scene where at least 10 people have been trampled to death during rioting following the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma. Ramaphosa told reporters that the government was really concerned about what happened and that they must do more to shore up security forces. At least 212 people have died since the protests began. Spyware developed by an Israeli firm and licensed to governments for tracking terrorists and criminals was also used to hack smartphones of human rights activists, business executives, and journalists. That's according to a global investigation by 17 media partners. The Israeli firm NSO Group says the findings of the media investigation are exaggerated and unfounded. The energy minister of the United Arab Emirates says OPEC and allied countries have reached a full agreement after an earlier dispute roiled oil prices. The comments by Suhail al-Muzaeh came after an online meeting Sunday to reach a deal, but he declined to offer details.
This is Science in a Minute.
July 14th was Shark Awareness Day, a holiday that brings attention to one of the world's most misunderstood creatures and recognizes their importance to the ecosystems of the world's oceans. There's a new study from 2 conservation psychology researchers at the University of South Australia, and it suggests hit shark movies like 1975's classic Jaws and others like The Meg and Open Water have changed the way people think of sharks. Researchers assessed how sharks are portrayed in movies and found that 96% of shark films are blatantly portraying sharks as a threat to humans. But conservationists say it's the sharks that are at risk of harm from humans than humans are from sharks, and the world's population of sharks is decreasing rapidly. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Pressure is ratcheting up against former President Donald Trump and his closest circle. His company, the Trump Organization, is under a criminal investigation on suspicion of fraud and other illegal financial dealings. Yet the former president remains popular among Republicans and wields an outsized influence over the party. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekaswara has the story.
Most former U.S. presidents stay largely out of the public eye, except when they're filmed kitesurfing like Barack Obama or launching a scholarship like Bill Clinton and George W. Bush.
people are going to be able to say when they finish this program, I learned a lot about leadership.
Donald Trump is different. He's still holding rallies, attacking President Joe Biden, and amplifying what Democrats call the big lie. In an informal poll at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Texas last week, Trump won 70% of the votes for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. Earlier this year, he hinted he might run again.
A Republican president will make a triumphant return to the White House, and I wonder who that will be.
Whether he will or not could depend on whether the Republican candidates he endorses win in the midterm congressional elections in 2022. Thomas Schwartz is a presidential historian at Vanderbilt University.
Trump still retains a very solid core of Republican support, which gives him a power within the party. It's not enough necessarily to win an election, but it's enough to win a Republican primary, enough to perhaps get renominated. They might lose because Trump carries so much baggage, but he might be able to indeed win the nomination again. And that's one of the reasons why I think Republican office holders are approaching him very cautiously, and you only have a few who are really willing to defy him directly.
Those who do pay the price. In May, Republicans in the House of Representatives ousted Liz Cheney from her leadership position after she repudiated Trump for baselessly claiming that Biden won the election due to fraud, leading to the January 6 storming of the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters.
We cannot be dragged backwards by the very dangerous lies of a former president.
Trump wields power even amid lawsuits and scandals. His company, the Trump Organization, is under criminal investigation on suspicions of fraud and other illegal business dealings. Trump's lawyer, Alan Futterfass, say the lawsuits are politically motivated.
I think in 244 years, we have not had a local prosecutor go after a former president of the United States. Or his employees or his company. And that is a significant line to cross.
And as Americans continue to grapple with the storming of the U.S. Capitol, a new book revealed that top U.S. military leaders were so concerned that Trump might attempt a coup after losing the November 2020 election, they had planned ways to stop him. Patsy Wirakuswara, VOA News.
More than 1,000 people marched on the office of Thailand's Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha on Sunday, angry at the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. David Doyle of Reuters News has more.
Thai police fired water cannon, tear gas and rubber bullets on Sunday to stop more than 1,000 people marching on the office of the Prime Minister. These anti-government protesters are calling for Prayut Chan-o-cha to resign. They accuse him and his government of mismanaging the COVID-19 pandemic. The demonstration also comes after the Thai government tightened restrictions. On Friday, it imposed a nationwide ban on public gatherings of more than five people. The maximum penalties are 2 years in prison, a 40,000 baht fine, or both. Protester Itanan says he's aware of the risks.
I understand that the situation is not getting any better, but we have to come out and show them that we're not happy about the measures imposed by the government. It's like they only wanted everything to stop at a standstill, but they were not trying to fix anything. Yes, I know that we are risking getting infected. That's why I tried to protect myself by wearing gloves and a gas mask, so that would be at low risk.
Police used force after some protesters tried to dismantle barbed wire and metal barricades leading to Government House, where the Prime Minister works. The protest marked 1 year since the first of a wave of large-scale street demonstrations led by youth groups that attracted hundreds of thousands of people across the country. Thailand reported 11,397 infections and 101 deaths on Sunday, bringing its cumulative total to more than 403,000 cases and 3,341 fatalities. The vast majority of them are from an outbreak since early April, which is fueled by the highly transmissible Alpha and Delta variants.
Reuters' David Doyle. And finally, if you'd like to keep ahead of the current trends in African music, we've got you covered. Ethnomusicologist and host of VOA's Music Time in Africa radio show, Heather Maxwell, has this roundup of the latest top three artists on the rise.
I've been discovering so many amazing emerging African artists recently. I just had to do a top three. Kenya, Botswana, and Nigeria are in the house today.
How could this be? How could this be? Yeah. How could it be? Blessings on me.
Karen is a 27-year-old singer-songwriter from Kenya. She's been in the game for about a decade or so. She has a music degree from Berklee College of Music, based in Boston, Massachusetts, USA, and has been rocking her solo career lately. In March 2021, she released an EP. It's called Catch a Vibe, including some hot, vibey visuals. Here's another beautiful emerging artist out of Southern Africa, and she's introducing herself.
Hi Heather, my name is Mposi Bina. I'm very excited to be on Music Time in Africa. I am a singer-songwriter from Botswana and I just released my latest video titled Dikeledi, which is available on YouTube, and the video is entirely in sign language. I just wanted to include the deaf community into my music, and yeah, I'm very excited about it.
West Africa, there's this young man with Where, and who also has a few words to say.
Hi, Little Maxwell. This is Dereeb Fulim Dereeb Benson, born and raised in Lagos, Nigeria. I'm an Afrobeat, Afropop, highlight musician, and I started my music career 5 years ago. My most recent single is titled Where, it's a song about love.
Took time to realize, took time for you to understand. You done made me the wonder, you done make me the man.
I just got signed to Eclair, partially home by Akon, and that's like a real stepping stone for me to keep making music, because I've been an independent artist all my life. And I think you should watch out for my next music coming out soon. It's like to say you love me. Thank you.
I'm Heather, and that's my top three recent amazing African emerging artists.
And that's going to do it for us on this Monday, July 19th. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.